Welcome everybody to the Locked On Lakers podcast. I'm Anthony Irwin. I'm joined today a very special guest. I've been looking forward to this since he made the announcement on Twitter that he will do any and every podcast he can possibly do to let people know about his book, which I've already started and is incredible. But Jeff Perlman, author of not just Three Ring Circus, which is the biggest and newest thing that's out there, but Showtime, Gunslinger about Brett Favre, Sweetness, The Rocket That Fell to Earth, just an incredible, I guess, grouping of books that you've been able to put together. That in and of itself is really impressive, but this new book is great. And I guess I'll start by asking, one, how are you holding up? And two, this book, how were you given this much access? I was astonished at how well documented this book is.
Well, first of all, I just want to say, when I said I would do any and every podcast, I actually meant except for this one. But then you asked, and I was like, I guess I'll do it. You know, whatever. You know, 6 o'clock, there's not much going on, you know. So here I am. No, thank you. That's very kind of you. It's really just a matter of calling people. Like, I just call people. You call Nick Van Exel, and you call Eddie Jones, and you call Corey Blount, and you call Mike Penberthy, and you call Turner and say, do you think Shaq would talk? And you get an email for Phil, and you email Phil Jackson, and you call Dale Harris. And most people generally want to talk when it comes to nostalgia. Like, most people. Most people like talking. But you're not asking about their time in prison. You're asking them about their time in the NBA. You know, it's a glorious time.
And when
time
they were winning.
Lives. And they were winning. And it's even if they were losing, though, like, people like talking about their greatest moments and their highs and sort of being part of this magical thing. So it's daunting because you're making a million calls and there's definitely a level of rejection. But overall, people are pretty happy to talk. So it's not as hard as you would think.
Who surprised you with how forthcoming they were in talking?
I mean, the first time I had a real, like, whoa interview was Samaki Walker, former Laker forward. I met Samaki at and those guys are really important. That's the thing people miss. Like, guys like Samaki Walker are super important because they're on the front lines, but they haven't talked about it that much. You know, like, for every one interview they do, Shaq has done 10,000 interviews.
Right.
So they have material that hasn't been heard. So I met up with Samaki at a coffee shop somewhere in LA, and he starts telling me the details. There was it's not that well known, but he had a pretty good fight with Kobe Bryant on a bus.
Yes. And I already read this part. It's incredible.
It's crazy. And hey, Samaki, you know, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I'll tell you about that. It's crazy. You know, so like, that was the first one. I was like, wow, this is great. You know, and one thing, and it's definitely an awkward sort of conversation to have, but it's true, is all these interviews are done well before Kobe Bryant died. And I think had they been done afterwards, you don't get nearly the same level of conversation, the same level of honesty, because understandably people are more protective and everyone just thought he was a guy and blah, blah, blah. Well, who cares if I tell the story? Kobe, you know, knows it. And so that's kind of an interesting dynamic at play here.
I wanted to actually bring up guys like Samaki Walker, guys like, you know, Nick Van Exel, whenever you get guys like that, they aren't as rehearsed, right? They aren't when they're giving some kind of response. Like you said, Shaq has done so many of these interviews, and before you spoke to him, you know, I'm sure Kobe and Phil Jackson, those guys have said all kinds of things, and they have their pre-written answers to basically any question, having been asked every question. But guys like Samaki Walker, and you know, I haven't gotten far enough in the book to know if you've talked to like Devin George or anybody like that. They are just happy to talk. That's one of the things that I've learned in this industry the most, is that you think going in, oh my God, I get to talk to Lakers, but they're like, oh my God, I get to talk about being a Laker.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny, like you mentioned Devin George, Division III player, Augsburg, first round draft pick of the Lakers. And he told me this great story. When he was a rookie, they didn't really haze players, but they all kind of saw Devin George as a weak link. Like, he wasn't that tough. And they were on the road, and after a practice, they stripped Devin George naked, put him on the floor of the basketball court, taped him there on duct tape, and left him there. And he had to get a janitor to free himself from the duct tape. And the janitor finds him naked taped to the floor. Like, you know, those kind of stories. Again, like, Devin George isn't getting called anymore to talk about the Lakers. Maybe if he's at a party or, you know, oh, this is Devin George. Oh, Devin, did you play for the Lakers? But they're not getting called for those kind of things. So everything you just said is true. Like, you can still get good stuff from Shaq if you ask the right questions. And you can still get good stuff from Phil if you ask the right questions. But, you know, when you talk to the sort of raw guys and the obscure guys, like, I'm big into training camp invitees. You'll see later in the book. I'm huge into guys, Eric Chenoweth and Paul Shirley or Jimmy King, who played summer league with Kobe. Like, those guys who really haven't told these stories, they're probably my favorites of all. I would take 10 of those over one Shaq in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I have to, since we were on the subject of Devin George, I have to bring the story up. And if you can corroborate it, great. But
okay.
There's apparently a story out there that Devin George approached Phil Jackson and asked him for more minutes. And Phil said, well, your minutes are going to come at Kobe's expense. And that's probably not going to happen. And he says, well, what could I possibly do to get more minutes? And Phil said, you know what? Play Kobe one-on-one. If you beat him one-on-one, you'll get more minutes. And George said, okay, let's do this. They call Kobe over, and Kobe just absolutely obliterates Devin George. Beats him. They played a game of 21. I think he beat him. The story goes, and as you pointed out, a lot of the stuff gets mythologized, especially with Kobe. But apparently Kobe beats him in a game of 21, like 21-2. And then George says, I want to do this again, 21-1. And he says, okay, fine. One more time. I got this time, 21-0. And I'm wondering if you've ever heard that story, and B, if that came up, because that was the kind of thing I think that comes up with a team like three ring or with like the three-peat Lakers. We have so much success and everybody thinks that they're the reason they're having that success. And that kind of rude reminder, nope, Kobe is the reason we're having this success, is kind of rare.
So I'll tell you, number one, I don't know that story. Mm. Number two, though, I'm skeptical, and here's why.
Okay.
There was a story, I think Horace Grant wrote a piece for the Players Tribune about the time Kobe decimated J.R. Ryder.
Oh, this might be, I might just have the names wrong then.
Okay, yeah, it might have been that. And yeah. Kobe had been wanting to play J.R. Ryder and J.R. Ryder. And according to the story, Ryder's like, screw you and blah, 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 and whatever it is. And they play, and Kobe just wipes the floor with J.R. Ryder, just embarrasses him. And you have different people collaborating. What is the word I'm looking
for? Corroborating.
Thank you. Corroborating. That's bad for Ryder.
I only knew it because I used it a second ago.
We're good. All right, nice. You know, this story and saying, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I start looking into it because it doesn't sound right. Like, it just doesn't sound right. J.R. Ryder was a really good NBA player. And J.R. Yeah. Ryder was a tough guy from Oakland. And so I start looking into it, and here's the truth of it. Kobe beat J.R. Ryder one-on-one. The not truth of it is they played to like 5. The final score is like 5-2 or 5-3. It wasn't a decimation. It wasn't. Yeah. I'm like, there's a lot of mythological elements to those sort of moments. And I'm not saying Kobe was dogged and Kobe was hard-nosed.
Yeah.
And he was a beast. There's no question about it. But like, so was J.R. Ryder, you know, yeah. So were a lot of these guys. And I don't know. It doesn't seem plausible to me that he beat Devin George, a legit NBA player, 21-0 or 21-2 in a game. So I don't know.
I also feel like when it gets to about, you know, 11-2, one guy's going to walk away.
Like, maybe
the point has been made. At that point,
I don't think it gets to 11-2. I just think, like, yeah. Devin George was a very good NBA player. He's going to be able to back Kobe down a little bit and score. You know, like, I don't know. So again, when I read that story with J.R. Ryder, I was just like, I don't know. And I talked to actually one of my key interviews was Mike Penberthy, who was a backup guard with the Lakers.
Shooting coach.
He is now the shooting coach of the Pelicans. And he's like, I was right there when they played. He goes, I don't know what those guys are talking about, but I was right there when they played. That's not even close to what happened. He goes, it was a pretty good game. It wasn't that big a deal. Kobe won and everyone walked away. And that was it. Hmm.
Let's take a quick second here. When we come back, I want to talk to you, Jeff, about this. I was shocked at the way that the Clippers were getting roasted last night, and you have now documented a ton of sports. And I was interested if you saw that as unique in the way that everybody was piling on this team, not just internet people who were looking for retweets, but contemporaries, you know, guys that these guys are competing against. So let's take a quick second. We'll come back and talk about that. Today's show is brought to you in part by rockauto.com. We have been talking about them for quite some time now, and I will continue talking about them for as long as I possibly can, simply because of how great an experience I have had every single time I have hopped on the site. It's the weirdest thing out here. A lot of the roads aren't necessarily even, is the word I'll go with, paved. Like my brother and sister-in-law lived on a road that was not paved, and that introduces all kinds of fun stuff that you have to look after with your car, and any, you know, kind of weird noise or whatever. I'm basically an expert at that, not just through the experience, but also because of how much time I have spent on rockauto.com just tooling around to make sure I know what tool I might need or what part I might need for my car. So head on over to rockauto.com, where you'll find a family-owned business that has been working with customers for 20 years, where you'll find a tremendous experience no matter what background you have, where you'll find reliably low prices no matter what background you have, and where you'll find every part that you could possibly think to look for. That's only on rockauto.com. rockauto.com has amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. rockauto.com, and tell them that you found us by writing, or that you found them through us by writing Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box. The reason I'm interested in this is because, you know, the Lakers, as a team that had the success that they did, and as a team that drew the headlines that they did, I would imagine there was a lot of schadenfreude with the Lakers by the time it was all said and done. There was a lot of people around the league very happy to see that run come to an end. But even there, and I was young, I don't remember or I don't recall the same kind of outpouring of that schadenfreude, that so many people were lining up to dunk on and dance on their graves. And with the Clippers, though, last night, there were so many people, whether it was writers, whether it was, you know, bloggers, whether it was just Twitter personalities, but most importantly to me, or most interestingly to me, were current NBA players. Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum had no problem whatsoever cracking their jokes about it. And I was wondering if you, in all of your time writing about teams like this, have seen a situation like that before?
Rare. My first book I ever wrote was about the 86 Mets, and they won the World Series, the whole Bill Buckner thing, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And they were super, super cocky, like super cocky.
Yeah.
And when they started to not play well in 1987, I mean, people made clear their joy over their demise. Like, they rooted for their demise. I think when the Chicago Bears won the Super Bowl with Walter Payton, and they did a music video, the Super Bowl Shuffle, mm-hmm. People were pretty happy when the next year they weren't very, you know, they weren't at the same level. This was weird to me. Number one, it was weird that the guys, like a lot of these athletes whose teams had been eliminated already, were saying it. Like, how are you talking trash? And the one that I actually hated the most, and this is what I wrote about today, was Magic Johnson talking trash.
Like, I saw your tweet about it.
I get it. Everyone's like, well, he wasn't wrong. It's like, yeah, it's fine. He wasn't wrong, but it just was classless. And Magic Johnson has, you know, experienced enough highs and lows in basketball to know, like, you're going to have your lows and you're going to have your moments. And I just thought it was weird. And the other thing is, like, this season is such a strange season, and you're asking players to go through stuff that's very unnatural.
Yeah.
You just are. And it doesn't mean you're weak if you're struggling with COVID or you're struggling with the bubble or whatever. It's just, it's a weird situation. Mm-hmm. And I think whoever emerges as a champion will remember them as a champion, and we'll actually, in a way, honor them more because of what they went through. But there'll also be a weird asterisk to it because it's a weird season.
Yeah.
I just thought overall it came off as classless and a little weak. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I kind of get that, especially seeing as, like, Paul George has talked about, you know, the impact that this is having on him psychologically and emotionally, right?
Yeah.
I get some of that. To me, my theory was basically that, like you mentioned the Bears, you know, the Walter Payton Bears. You mentioned the Mets and how people were excited to see that team fall short. But those teams won, right? Like they were brash and they were
sure.
cocky. And like to me, the difference between cockiness and arrogance is cockiness is earned. And I thought here with the Clippers, to me, it felt like, okay, this is, you can be excited about the team that you have. You can be excited about pairing up Paul George and Kawhi Leonard and teaming that with a team that won 50 wins anyway last year without them. But, you know, like them dogging Michael K. Gilchrist, where he was shooting a wide open shot. And as he released the ball, they were all laughing at him from the sideline. That to me was something that, like you said, every NBA player can attest to, can speak to a moment where they're left out on that island and they realize as they're shooting it, I'm out here on this island shooting this wide open jumper for a reason. And getting dogged for it was I thought for a lot of players was when the Clippers seemed to cross the line. And yeah, I agree with you that some of it, like Magic, seems like there'll always be a choker or something like that. Especially for Magic with his Twitter account. I think that might've been the only tweet he ever sent himself. I don't think he went through a middleman to send that one, but yeah, I was interested in getting your thoughts on this because usually teams are happy because the run of success is over. Whereas like last night teams were just happy, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I know what you're saying. And mm-hmm. I guess it's kind of didn't really think about the Michael Kidd-Gilchrist thing. It's sort of a fair point that if you, you know, you reap what you sow and chickens come home to roost. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just think most teams would have been doing that to Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. I don't think the Clippers have this such a unique collection of bad guys who it was so unique. I just think most teams would have done that. And most teams, I mean, you can look at every NBA team or every professional sports team and find an element you don't like, find players you don't like, find a reason to hate them. Like, that's kind of what we do.
Right.
I have a lot of respect for Kawhi Leonard. I think that guy's a freaking hard-nosed, dogged hard player. You know, I kind of respected Paul George's honesty. I like Doc Rivers as a coach. I don't know. Maybe I'm just – I might be a little old-fashioned for this stuff, but I didn't love it. But mm-hmm. I'm an old guy, you know.
So now to kind of get back to the book, I was interested in – you know, when you go into a story that was so deeply covered at the time, right? Like there was so much written about the circus that these guys were. Did you find that as a, you know, that did you find that the amount of documentation on it helped you, or did you find that there was a bit of a hindrance in trying to find something unique to talk about with this team?
No, I think it helps overall because all right, so just as an example, Kobe's rookie year, playoffs, Utah, 4 air balls, kind of goes down as an epic collapse, right? So you read everything about that, and there was a wealth of material written about Kobe and the air balls against Utah. Mm-hmm. But then you start thinking, all right, what can I add to this? Well, I'm going to call the different members of the Jazz who are on the bench at that time, or I'm going to call the different members of the Jazz who are there, and I want to understand what they were seeing when that happened, you know, because – thing is, usually when things like that happen, it's a article in the newspaper, there's a column in the newspaper, then we move on to the next thing. So I'm going to go back, mm-hmm. I'm going to dig deeper and deeper and deeper. So I start talking to Jazz players about it. I know they were so thrilled to see Kobe Bryant, of all people, shooting the ball. Like, it was, give them the ball again, let him shoot the ball. And so, like, there was also a moment when Shaq smacked Greg Ostertag before a game. Just walked up to him, bare palmed, smacked him, Ostertag falls to the ground. There'd been some written about it, not a ton, but some. Well, then I want to know what players think. And I want to know what they remember about it. And so the more material there is, it just gives you sort of an idea of what happened. And it's your job to dig beneath the details and find new stuff. Maybe stuff that people would have been intimidated to discuss back then, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting in that, you know, finding different angles to the story. But in finding those different angles to those stories, did you – you know, did you ever run up against I guess that's already been told before. Or did you, sure. did you find for the most part that, you know, the guys that you were talking about, especially like the Grey Ghoster tags, for example, those guys, well, they haven't talked about it in a long time. So there might be some new morsel that they were able to tell you about.
Yeah, it's a little of both. I mean, when you're rewriting game stories, just as an example, like my least favorite part of writing these books is writing about the games. My favorite part is writing about the people. Mm-hmm. And when you're rewriting a game, you know, you're writing about the action during this championship series against Indiana. Well, that has been well chronicled, and it is hard. You might be able to get what people are thinking or seeing in certain points, but that's hard. It's hard to be overly fresh on that. So you just do your best and you try to find little angles or little things or maybe little moments, but it's hard. But one of the keys definitely like that I'm big into, Greg Ostertag didn't talk, but I called him multiple times. But Adam Key from that team talked, and Stephen Howard talked, and different members of the team talked, and they gave me the perspective of where they were and what they were thinking. And also, like when Greg Ostertag was smacked, what I found funny was Adam Key was his teammate. He was a Utah forward. And he basically just watched Ostertag on the ground and thought, well, you kind of had that coming. You know, like, stuff like that is kind of cool. So you just try to get those perspectives, you know?
I would have been marveling that he didn't die. Like, getting smacked by Shaq.
He did an open fist. And also, Ostertag was 7 foot, you know, 3 something. Yeah. He was no tiny guy, you know.
Right. Why did he say that he had it coming there? I'm interested there.
Oh, because after Utah eliminated the Lakers in the playoffs, that for the second year in a row. At the end of that series, Ostertag talked trash about Shaq. Mm. Shaq hated it. He was pissed. Now it's the next season, it's a preseason game. I think it was preseason. Shaq says something like, you know, hey, I saw what you wrote in the paper about me. I do not appreciate that. Ostertag basically says, screw you. And Shaq goes, pop. Keith was like, number one, Shaq is a much better player than you are. You probably shouldn't be talking trash about him.
Right.
And also, they didn't really like the player. Members of the Jazz didn't really like Greg Ostertag that much. So, you know. Funny.
See, that's the kind of stuff that they can say after the fact, right? All these years after the fact. And he's like, you know what? That guy sucked anyway. So
yeah, at the time you would never say that. You know, you wouldn't be like, you know, yeah. So that's kind of cool. I like that stuff. I love digging into stuff like that. It's fun.
Yeah. Let's take another quick second here. When we come back, I want to talk about, you know, because I have only just started reading the book, and the first, you know, I know the foreword is a story from Samaki Walker about Kobe. The first chapter, I believe. One of the first chapters is about Kobe and the way that he made his way to the Lakers and stuff like that. And one of the points that you made about him was that he wasn't fully comfortable in his own skin, especially early on. And now having seen him, unfortunately, we have to talk about him in the past tense, but now having seen him grow more comfortable in his own skin and eventually mature as a fully fledged adult, I thought it was really interesting to actually watch that because I agree with you completely in the point that you make in the book. So let's take a quick second and come back. We'll talk about that. So the Kobe stuff is interesting, not just because you make the point, because that's a point I think that a lot of people have made previously, right? Like he was literally doing a Michael Jordan impersonation when he got to the league. Yeah. And, you know, so to point out that he wasn't fully comfortable in necessarily his own skin, I thought, okay, yeah, we've been here. And then to really go about building up how that came to be. And one of the lines that you close a chapter with was like, or not close a chapter with, but one of the real points that you hammer home hard was that like basketball was really all Kobe had. And basketball, you know, it develops interpersonal relationships with teammates, but it's hard to learn your human interaction from a competitive sport. And I thought that was really interesting to frame where Kobe came from and how he came to be in this way, where there weren't very many opportunities for him to be very comfortable. And I'm wondering when do you think that transition into becoming more comfortable as Kobe Bryant started to take place?
That's a great, I actually don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I, when I was, back in the mid 90s, I lived in New York City. I was working for Sports Illustrated. And my roommate was a guy named Russ Bankston. And Russ was the editor of Slam Magazine. And this is when Slam Magazine. Oh, yeah. Russ is a great guy. Yeah, I went to college with Russ in Delaware. And Russ is a great guy. And I was working for SI, and Russ was at Slam. And at that point in time, hip-hop and basketball were really beginning to intertwine.
Mm-hmm.
And Allen Iverson, with his hair blown out, tats, jewelry, you know, it was a thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And Stephon Marbury, Steph and KG, and this thing about basketball back then, it was really vibrant. And it was sort of like, it'd be, you know, basketball and Tupac, or basketball and Ice Cube, and like hoops and sport, and it was this thing, right? And it was cool. And I remember when they put Kobe Bryant on the cover of Slam, and it didn't really work. Like it just didn't really work. Like Kobe was a kid in Italy who then moved to the leafy suburbs of Philadelphia. You know, he wasn't hard.
Went to a predominantly white school.
Yeah, in the suburbs. And like, he was a great basketball player, great basketball player. But I think it was a confusing upbringing for the guy. I think that's pretty clear and pretty well documented. And a lot of his time, especially in those younger days, were spent masquerading. He was mimicking Michael Jordan. Sometimes he was mimicking Allen Iverson. Sometimes he was mimicking Vince Carter. This effort to really find who he was. And he went through phases. He went through phases where he was hard Kobe. Went through phases when he was soft Kobe. He went through phases when he was intellectual Kobe. His teammates never really knew him that well. None of them were invited to his wedding. None of them even knew he was getting married. Most of them thought he probably was a virgin. They just didn't know him. And there was, I imagine the amount of effort that goes into trying to present yourself as something, but not really knowing who you are, has to be exhausting. And I just think a lot of those guys on the Lakers saw through him and saw that this was just kind of a kid trying to figure it out.
It's tough because, you know, not only does he come straight from that background that you're talking about, right, where he's raised in Italy and then he goes to the suburbs of Philly and, you know, is then thrust into one of the most well-known teams and well-documented teams ever, plays a central role in all of that, not just in terms of the success that they had, but eventually some of their, you know, there was a big reason why they took a downturn, was obviously a big reason why Shaq departed. And I think all the while all of that is going on, I don't think at any point really, based on, you know, your framing of it and what I know about Kobe too, he never really got the opportunity to actually take a step back and say like, okay, this is who I am. Especially once he got to the Lakers, there wasn't really a time for him to say like, this is who I am. He was, and I think one of the themes, at least early on in this book, is that he was a lot more focused on developing his game as a basketball player than he ever was developing himself as a human being.
I mean, think about it. Like, we all have natural courses of development that almost all of us go through, right? Mm-hmm. We really do. Like, go to high school, you meet someone and you have awkward dating moments where you like a girl, you like a boy, and you try asking that person out and they reject you and you feel awful and blah, blah, blah. And you all the things, right? Everything. You get your driver's license for the first time and you go through these experiences and you're in high school and there's some bully and you have to deal all these developmental experiences that actually make you who you are. And it's this path you take. And maybe you go to college and you start to develop and you learn different ways. Well, he didn't really have that. He was brought up in Italy. He comes to America. He's a basketball phenom from a very young age. He knows he's going to skip college and go straight to the NBA. He's a celebrity very young. He goes to a senior prom with the singer Brandy, who he'd never even met before. Like, it's all kind of weird and crazy and skips a lot of the natural developmental stages. And there's a moment in the book that I thought was really telling. And it happened during the 2003-04 season. It was Karl Malone was on the Lakers that year. Mm-hmm. And it was the last game before Thanksgiving. And all the Lakers were leaving the clubhouse, or they're wrapping up the locker room. And Kobe's walking out. And Malone goes, "Yo, young buck, come here, come here." He calls him over and he whispers something to him real softly. And then Kobe goes to each teammate and says, "Hey, have a good Thanksgiving. Have a good Thanksgiving. Make sure you have a good Thanksgiving." And there's literally Karl Malone telling him, you know, listen, what you should do is tell everyone, have a good Thanksgiving.
Huh.
Little things like that, just little things like that were missing in his societal development. And I think when you asked, like people have asked me a lot, like, did teammates like him? I think teammates didn't understand him mostly, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you look, one more thing, there's a long army of veteran players brought in to quote unquote help and guide Kobe, from Byron Scott early on and Jerome Kersey early on, mm-hmm. to J.R. Reed, to Derek Harper, to Brian Shaw. It's just a long litany of players. John Sally, can you take Kobe aside? Can you take Kobe aside? Can you take Kobe aside? And it was always pretty futile because he was a freaking stubborn, determined.
I was going to ask, how did he take to those things?
No, not that well. Not that well.
Last thing before we get out of here, the where I'm at right now is you kind of documented how Kobe gets to the Lakers and then how Shaq also gets to the Lakers. And I was really surprised, you know, part of it is because he's such a huge human being and he's just so bulletproof seemingly. But the way that Shaq was so, I can't say visibly, right, because it's not that kind of a medium, but so obviously shook by the treatment he got from Orlando heading to the Lakers, right? How I kind of believe him when he said initially, I did want to go back to the Magic, but that first contract offer, which was, I think, $56 million compared to the contract he eventually got was $120 million. Like, that's offensive. Yeah. And I was interested in, you know, when you're talking to him and when you're documenting that entire kind of stretch of basketball history in this era of player empowerment, where not only do guys, you know, kind of dictate what contractual terms they're going to have, but also like what teammates are going to have, coaches that they want to play for, the way that the uniform is going to look, all of these things. Did you ever kind of take a step back and say, holy crap, we've really come a long way?
Oh, holy crap, we have come a long way. I mean, he was kind of, yeah, I mean, it's just interesting. Like, if you think about it nowadays, if someone of that stature is a free agent,
heading towards being the most dominating player ever.
Yeah, arguably. You know, I'd say Chamberlain is there too, but yeah, uh-huh. Shaq, Chamberlain, Kareem are probably the big three. He would have a say over who the coach is. Like, if the Lakers are wooing him and he's like, I don't want to play for Dale Harris. Well, Dale Harris isn't going to be the coach of the Lakers very long. Mm-hmm. And I don't want this guy there and I want this guy there and I want you to bring in this guy. Well, they're going to do it. It's a completely and totally different world. And it's funny, I don't think he ever was going to go back to the Magic. I mean, it's debatable. He kind of says he has. I just don't think his agent, Leonard Amato, was trying to get him to go to LA for years and years and years. And Shaq really did want to be this multi-level entertainer. And he wanted to do movies and he wanted to do hip hop and he wanted to be this spokesperson. And he had been told for years, LA is a place where you're going to do that. And it was hard to argue. LA was a place where he was going to do that. And thanks to that move, we were able to have the cinematic masterpieces of Kazam and Steel. So,
yeah.
Have you seen either?
I've seen Kazam. I don't think I saw the other one, but
Kazam is a special movie.
It actually, the guy who used to co-host this with me has a pod where he just goes back and rewatches old movies, and one of the first ones that he did was Kazam, and he just marveled at every step along the way.
So bad.
Every aspect of that masterpiece. The Shaq thing though, do you think the focus, like you said, was hey, I want to go to LA because I want to be this multifaceted, you know, Hollywood superstar. Do you think in this era where a lot of guys are able to do that through Zoom meetings and they're able to get all that put together, do you think there would have been such a focus on LA for him if he was playing nowadays and that totally was more possible?
It's a totally different world. That's actually a really good question. First of all, you can catch every game anywhere, anytime, right? So you can be in Kazakhstan and watch the Orlando Magic game, you know, and it's just a different, it's a reason the Knicks can never get anyone. You know, 30 years ago, the Knicks were a marquee place to be because you're going to be in New York and it's endorsement center and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter anymore. So I actually agree with you that it's completely different. And maybe, I mean, Have you spent time in Orlando?
I've tried not to.
It sucks. So like, I mean, I'm not trying to turn off Orlando, but it sucks. It's there's nothing there except Disney and a bunch of strip malls. So mm-hmm. I think if you have the option of being in LA, which is a pretty fun place, in Orlando, Florida, you still might be going to LA just because who wants to live in Orlando, Florida?
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. Was there, what was the toughest thing to cut? And I'll get you out of here on that. Like, you know, you documented all the stuff, and I can't wait to get more into the book, which by the way, you guys can find everywhere that you find books. Check out jeffproman.com, not just for this book, but also for all of the other books that he's written. Showtime, which I read previously, was also really good. If you're open to it, I want to bring you back on here to talk about Showtime at some point.
Of course.
But you know, in writing this, there's always that one thing that was hardest to cut over everything else. What do you think that would be?
I'm going to give you the least sexy answer ever.
All right.
It doesn't really happen with me. I always get asked that question. They'll be like, so what was the one thing? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I mean, there's some players I probably would have enjoyed going into their backgrounds a little more. You know, that just because of space. Like I was definitely fascinated by the life journey of Mark Madsen. but I don't know how many other people are, and you know, you have to cut somewhere. But I think to flip that a little on its head, I wish I had time, would have had time to devote a little more to Kobe Bryant after his death and kind of the legacy and what he means and you know, the post Shaq transition. That's one area that's probably, it's not there because I couldn't do it, but you know, yeah, I don't know.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of the Locked On Lakers podcast. Jeff, thank you a ton for hopping on. Congratulations on this book. It's very, very good to this point. I can't wait.
It's all downhill from here.
Well, especially now that you've come on the show.
Yeah.
Like, your name is now officially in the dirt.
Once you hit page 50 of the book, it turns to, it's all about the 1992 Clippers. So it just changes.
I'm more interested in like the Darius Miles Clippers, the Quentin Richardson Clippers. Like if there's ever a book written about that team, I would absolutely read that one.
All right.
But thank you very much. Anywhere specifically that you want to send people for the book?
No, wherever, you know, it's available wherever books are sold. I'm just honored if anyone better reads it. It's an honor to me.
Well, I'm telling you, if you enjoy this podcast, you're going to really enjoy that book. So thank you a ton, Jeff, for hopping on. And hopefully, yeah, let's talk again soon to talk about Showtime.
Thank you so much.
All right. Everybody, we'll be back tomorrow to preview the Lakers and Nuggets series. Have a great rest of your day. Make somebody else's.